Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Well, everybody, the day has finally come. Today, we're going to talk about the films of Mr. Ringo Starr, movie star himself and Oscar winner, Stephen. He's an Oscar winner.
Yes, indeed. And yes, indeed.
But not for his acting.
No. Not for his singing either.
No, but, just for being in the room.
In the room.
For Let It Be. And even though we've had lots of requests from people to, you know, talk about A Hard Day's Night or Help, we're going straight to the important movies here, where we're going to talk about the movies where Ringo is, his name is up on the marquee.
If these movies
even made it to a cinema.
I was going to say it's top billing, even though he's not necessarily the top leading actor. But
it's an interesting body of work, and I think it's fair to say that this is going to be a bit of a laid back look at Ringo's movie career. But you know, cometh the hour, cometh the man. And Stephen, you have sat down and watched all of these films.
I was going to say, you know, it's an episode that I think commanded the most research.
certainly time-wise,
and we both put the R's in.
Yes, and it's also one of these ideas that wouldn't die. I'm mindful of, you know, when Monty Python had Holy Grail out, somebody said, "What's your next movie?" And they just jokingly said, "Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory," and that was an idea that just eventually turned into Life of Brian. And I think we were knocking about podcast ideas, and the films of Ringo Starr just wouldn't go away. It just was begging to be done, I think.
Yeah, I think you're setting the bar quite high, comparing it with Life of Brian. But yes, I get your point.
So the way I see it, Stephen, is, you know, Ringo's always been around. He's always been, you know, he's always liked a camera. He's never been shy. But the main body of his movie work, we're kind of looking at this 1968 to 1981 arc of a career, the rise, sort of,
and the rise and rise,
and then
Ringo
the opposite
Starr.
Of a rise. But it's kind of, we'll address this when we look at the movies. It's kind of in three parts, where he starts off and he's in the Beatles, and it becomes like his accessory career, and then he finds himself solo and he's given it a serious go.
Yeah,
and then time passes and he's maybe enjoying the lifestyle more than the art of acting.
Yes, I think that's fair comment.
That's fair. But Ringo, I guess we have to start by saying, you know, he gets this label of being an actor because of his Hard Day's Night moment, doesn't he?
Yes, the walk along the canal and the summoning up the pathos of the common man, or just hungover.
Yeah, well, there's that too, because he was hungover, wasn't he?
He says very sort of disarmingly, I got a lot of singled out for a lot of praise for that scene, but really I just had a hard night the night before. And
literally a hard night.
Yeah.
And it seems to give him though a certain license that he gets this label of being the actor after A Hard Day's Night. Ooh. And, you know, Hard Day's Night is brilliant. And we'll do an episode on A Hard Day's Night at some point. But he, you know, he's literally just being Ringo, being handed a script where they're all being heightened versions of themselves. And he's not really acting. But he's very charismatic. And there's a difference.
Yes, what you're trying to say is he's just, all he has to do is act naturally.
Hey.
But I think one of the things is that he's also the key player in the Help plot.
Yes, this is true.
Everything else sort of revolves around him. So he is kind of put forward into that front and center role. And even in Magical Mystery Tour, you know, he's the one on the bus with Aunt Jessie. Again, he's got a little bit more dialogue, such as it is.
Yeah, but Magical Mystery Tour is where you see that kind of style of Ringo acting, which is kind of totally...
It's this very kind of deadpan, unsubtle hand. But there is a certain charm to that.
Yeah.
And you know, it is his sort of calling card. And when it works, it's spectacular. But when it really is not appropriate,
it's not
spectacular. Yeah,
and listen, who are we to mock or judge? He has made significantly more films than you or I, Stephen.
So far,
until the Nothing Is Real movie hits the big screen.
Yes.
So let's get down to it, because, you know, it did take a global pandemic for us to sit down in 2020 and pass the time in front of these movies.
It was a perfect way to pass the time.
Yeah, just to see what the world has to offer. So let's look at this first phase where he's in the Beatles and he is making movies. And there's two movies that fall under this remit, which are Candy from 1968 and The Magic Christian from 1969. So let's start with Candy. What's Candy about?
Well, do you want to put in a disclaimer at this point?
This is true. We did talk, myself and Stephen off mic, that there are certain topics that are coming up in discussing the movies of Ringo Starr that are might have an adult tone. So if you've got children or, you know, loved ones in and around wherever you're listening to your podcasts, just be mindful that the topics might go into the bawdy. Should we say the bawdy?
Slightly bawdy. These films are of their time.
Yeah, so tell us about the sex farce Candy.
Okay, well, it's a common everyday story. High school student Candy Christian descends to Earth from space. Following a poetry recital, she goes home with Richard Burton.
Right.
And one of the critics described as seems permanently to be walking into a headwind with his hair. She has many adventures, sex with many men, and then returns to space.
So, and it could only have been made in 1968, probably.
It is. I mean, this is based on a novel from the late 50s, but and supposedly it's a satire on pornographic stories, but sort of generally ends up just being a pornographic story itself.
Yeah, there's a certain type of thing in the late 60s that presents itself as some kind of liberalized way of thinking about sex and life. And actually, it's just more of the same male wish fulfillment fantasy BS, really.
Well, yes. And these sort of big ensemble pieces where you have half a dozen or a dozen stars of the day. You know, I'm thinking Woody Allen sex comedies, that style of thing, Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex.
Terry Southern had been involved in Casino Royale the year before.
Exactly.
Which is a similar kind of vibe.
So it's absolutely of its time, 67, 68, 69. Could not have been made any other time.
And Terry Southern has he's an interesting guy because he casts a spell over these movies in a way.
He does. I mean, he's I didn't know much about him, but he sort of was present in all of the cool places. So he was in Paris after the war, sort of literary scene there. He moved to Greenwich Village in the 1950s. He's hanging out with the Beats in swinging London in the 60s. As you say, he wrote dialogue for Dr. Strangelove, Casino Royale, Barbarella, if you know that film.
Yeah.
Again, very much, I was going to say, of a piece with Candy, you know. One of my favourite films as a teenager, I should say.
There are certain movies in this that kind of... do you remember, what was it called? Was it Moviedrome, when Alex Cox used to present these BBC Two movies on a Sunday night? They used to pop up in that slot. This is about, I think, late 80s, early 90s on BBC Two. And it'd be Sunday night, here's a cult film. And so these kind of movies would pop up. I remember Barbarella popped up there one week.
After your parents had gone to bed.
But Barbarella is kind of good. You know, it still has a bit of cultural impact. You know, Kylie made a Barbarella video, you know, in homage.
Do you remember the name of the Milo O'Shea character?
Wasn't it Duran Duran?
Duran Duran.
Duran Duran. So, so with that there to blame for Duran Duran. But it's interesting because Terry Southern, who's involved in a couple of Ringo projects, you kind of think, man, why was Ringo tying his wagon to this guy? But he's been involved in, as you say, Dr. Strangelove, Casino Royale, Barbarella. He gets involved after this with Easy Rider. So he does have form, and he has been involved in some notable projects.
He does. And then he seems to sort of fall on hard times.
Mm.
So he's got a Blink and You'll Miss It cameo in The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah.
And then, tragically, he ends up writing for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, now he writes in early 80s Saturday Night Live. So I'm quite a Saturday Night Live fan, and Stephen is the opposite, fair to say?
I think that's very fair.
And he wrote in the 81-82 season where Lorne Michaels had left and the cast was in free fall and turnover and they were trying to kind of rebuild the show. But I don't actually know what particular pieces he wrote for the show. The writer's room is kind of a different thing back then. And then he dies in the 90s. He kind of doesn't, he doesn't really have a final act.
No, he just sort of fades away. Yeah, and, but as you say, Ringo is involved in this project, Magic Christian, and he also at one point had sort of optioned another story called Blue Movie.
Do we know what that's about?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
It does what it says on the
yeah, I'd worry. Is it literally a blue movie?
But it was never made. But he does seem to be very sort of present, Terry Southern, in the late 60s. There is a soundtrack to Candy that came out on Apple, but only in the US, I think.
Who's on that? Is Ringo on that?
No. Ringo has a very, I'm tempted to say he's a very small part, but that's just
steady.
That's innuendo.
Carry on, Candy.
For the sake of innuendo. But he plays a Mexican gardener.
Well, full disclosure here, Stephen. Out of all the movies we're talking about today, there's two of them I have not seen in full, and Candy is one of them because, you know, life is too short.
You have children in the house.
Well, yeah, that's true. And everybody's in the house these days. Candy, you really can just dial up the 5 minutes that Ringo is in. And it's on YouTube and he plays a Mexican gardener and it's as bad
it's
as
it's as shockingly bad as you would imagine,
like cultural appropriation or whatnot, you know, but he's, you know, see monsieur and all that kind of stuff.
But it's even leaving that aside, it's a shocking piece of miscasting.
Well, here's the thing I find interesting about this, because this movie is in 1968, and if my timeline is right, he leaves the recording of the White Album to go off and do some of this. And he is, like, we can look back now and kind of laugh at some of this, but he is, goddammit, Ringo from the Beatles in the summer of 1968. What's he doing? What is the path that gets him on a plane and into a studio to record this awful scene in a film? Like, doesn't make sense.
Well, I think you don't have to look further than the cast list.
Yeah. So we'll go through the list there.
Okay. Well, I mean, Candy herself, you know, she was an unknown. She was Miss Teen Sweden in 1965, Miss Teen International in 1966.
Right.
And,
She was 15 when she was Miss Teen Sweden. So she's 18 when she makes Candy.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
She looks a bit like Catherine Deneuve.
Yeah.
But the best quote in the sort of reviews, you know, she went on to star in several films after this and said many of her films were sex comedies set in the Middle Ages. I think that tells you all you need to know.
Okay.
But the key thing here for Ringo, I suspect, is the rest of the cast. So you've got James Coburn.
Yeah.
Walter Matthau.
Yeah.
John Huston.
Yeah.
Marlon Brando.
Yeah, Brando pops up, yeah.
So why would you not want to be, you know, these were big
stars.
Yeah, no,
it's really a curious thing. And Ringo comes in as a Mexican gardener and it's a strange scene, and he ends up squiring Candy and
how very delicately put.
Yes, squiring is what I'm going to call it.
Well, he's squiring Candy while Richard Burton is squiring a mannequin in the background.
But it does give yeah, that's true. It does give an impression as to just some of the chaos that's around the Beatles in 68 that a good manager wouldn't have, like I can't see Epstein would have signed off on that at all.
I think Brian Epstein, you remember, this is Brian Epstein sort of said you can't go near, you know, this topic or that topic for your follow up film. You know, they looked around Joe Wharton.
Yeah,
he wasn't letting them near the Joe Wharton script. So no, I think Brian Epstein would not have let. And I mean, I don't think we can really recommend anybody go and watch this film.
No, it's just terrible. So that's Candy from 1968. Marks out of 10, Stephen.
2 out of 10.
2 out of 10. Right. But it is inexorably kind of linked to the other film that Ringo makes when he's still in the Beatles, which is The Magic Christian, which is probably more well known. And that comes out in 1969. It's made in February 69, just after the Let It Be session. So January 69 is the again, big month.
This is one of the pressures on that session, that Ringo is committed to doing this. So yeah. those sessions have to end at a certain point.
And this is what he does between Let It Be and eventually getting back into what becomes Abbey Road.
Yes. And again, there's a sort of a broader connection because there's a soundtrack that's on Apple.
Yep.
And the big song is
Come and Get It.
By
Paul McCartney, I believe, is his name. So The Magic Christian, people here probably, out of all these movies, this is the one that they might have seen. Hmm. But what's it about?
A millionaire adopts a homeless man, and together they bribe everyone they meet to do things they would never usually do in order to make a point about money and capitalism or something.
Yes, it's a bit preachy. And it stars Ringo and Peter Sellers.
Yes.
And Peter Sellers is this kind of eccentric, very wealthy millionaire person. And Ringo is a homeless guy.
Sleeping in the park.
And yeah. Peter Sellers just adopts them, and they go about, it's basically a series of sketches of them doing outrageous things with money.
It is. And again, it's a style of film that comes from the late 60s.
Yeah.
It has every sort of British character actress or actor working there. You know, you've got Hattie Jakes, you've got Proto Monty Python, John Cleese, Graham Chapman, Richard Attenborough is in it.
He is.
I like this film, I have to say.
It was set up to be kind of Ringo's big break, as far as I can see, because he's a co-starring role. Peter Sellers is always fascinating to watch, whether he's appearing on the Sykes sitcom or whether he's headlining in a being there. He's always a very magnetic performer, and obviously him and Ringo were friends.
Yes, I mean, Sellers is sort of moving in their circle.
Yeah.
And I think they were all Goons fans. You know, Sellers was sort of instrumental in that, coming out of the late 50s, early 60s. But I think he was genuinely fascinated by stardom.
Mm.
Sellers was fascinated by stardom and other. So I think he was sort of intrigued to be in that world.
Yeah. And again, it's Terry Southern, who wrote a book in 1959. Now, the original book was set in the US. And then the script gets a pass through from John Cleese and Graham Chapman, who at the time, this would have been pre-Monty Python. Monty Python doesn't hit the air till October 69. And this is being filmed at the start of 69. So Monty Python hasn't even happened yet, but they are television writers writing for shows like The Frost Report and Doctor in the House and At Last the 1948 Show that they are in. So they are starting to make a name for it. And it's kind of obvious when you watch it that the bits that aren't in the book originally are the scenes with Cleese, which is in an auction house, and the scenes with Chapman, which is the Oxford-Cambridge boat race. They're the bits that they obviously shoehorned in themselves.
Yes. I mean, the Cleese sketch is just Monty Python.
The Cleese sketch is probably the best bit. And you see Cleese being, before he became so wheezy and miserable, which is how I see him today. But he, I think Cleese is, all the things that he became famous for in subsequent years is in his little scene. This kind of repressed, snobbery, haughty attitude. It is probably the best scene in the film, and it is obviously a Python written scene in disguise.
Clearly, I mean, you could take that little sketch and put it into any Python show, I think, and it would work. It's very interesting to see the origins
in there. And Graham Chapman's a bit more fleeting, but I have to say, overall, I don't like The Magic Christian.
You didn't like it.
I first saw it about, it must have been about 25 years ago, and it came out on home video, VHS, you remember, tapes.
Yeah.
And I bought it, and I was like, oh, I'm so looking forward to seeing this. It's Monty Python, it's The Beatles, it's Peter Sellers. This is going to be fantastic. And it's kind of, it's got that, again, it's obviously of its time, but it's so unsubtle, and it's so kind of, Yeah, there's a deep cynicism to it, you know?
Oh, do you know? Well, do you know, what I liked about it is there's lots of sort of business going on in the background to every scene.
Yeah.
So you have a scene on a train and Hattie Jakes is there and she's reading a book about kind of Nazi war crimes.
Yes,
and it's
is.
Never mentioned or alluded to. And it's just, so every scene has something else.
Yeah.
Going on. Some of it is, as you say, it's very unsubtle and it does kind of bang you over the head with the sort of the moral and
Is very annoying. It's very kind of gross.
The ending
and grim.
It reminds me of those Spike Milligan Q shows where they don't know how to end a sketch, so they just go, "What are we going to do now? What are we going to do now?" And they wander off camera, and it is a bit. Yeah, there's no resolution to anything.
And there is no plot to it. It's basically just a series of, you know, setups for them to spend their money. Now, one of my favorite films of that era, because I'm a Monkees fan, is the movie Head, which is a movie I really love and I've watched many, many times. But I've watched it many times because I think the musical set pieces are great and they're quite charismatic. And it is kind of, it does poke fun and it's of the TV show. And it's got the TV show to refer to. Whereas something like this, I'm not sure, it's hard to know who it's for really, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. I think if you went to see this in the cinema in 1969, you'd have found it hilarious. You know? It is a period piece. Again, it's got a great cast. If you want to see Yul Brynner in drag.
Yes.
If you want to see Raquel Welch.
Yeah. But be warned, it's got Rowan Polanski in it as well.
I've forgotten about that.
I rewatched it again, obviously for the purposes of science. And there's a couple of interesting bits on it. It has the day in the life chord is in it. There's a bit where they get off the boat and you hear the actual chord from the end of A Day in the Life. And the Magic Christian in the movie is a ship and it's this famous launch. And you actually see John and Yoko lookalikes getting onto the ship.
Yes, because when I first saw this film, which would have been before Moviedrome, there was a sort of, it was probably on a Saturday night when I was about 14 or 15.
Yeah.
They would show these movies from the 60s, you know, Magic Christian, Two Lane Blacktop, Steel Yard Blues, Silent Running, Dark Star, all of those movies. I actually thought it was real news footage.
Yeah.
Of John and Yoko getting onto the ship. But it was very disappointing to find out that it was just lookalike.
But it is interesting. The choreographer is Lionel Blair, who was in A Hard Day's Night. It does have a scene that reminds me, I know we said Cleese and Chapman are in it. It does have that scene in the restaurant, which is a bit like The Meaning of Life, Mr. Creosote scene many years later, where he's just getting food thrown at him.
That also reminded me of the, spaghetti and Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah, that's true. And Sellers, as I said, is always worth watching. And the scenes at the end in the South Bank, it's interesting to see an unbuilt South Bank in London
beside
the NFT or the BFI South Bank.
But the absolute star, apart from it's a very good soundtrack.
Oh yes,
what
is your favourite moment, Stephen?
Well, my favourite... I have watched certain scenes more than once.
Yeah, so what's your favourite scene?
Well, I may have watched the Raquel Welch scene more than once.
Yes.
Or twice. Or maybe three times. But the real star of this film is Ringo's hair.
Ringo's hair is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, he's front of Let It Be Ringo is what he is.
His hair is amazing. It's like he just stepped out of a shampoo advert.
Yeah. My other favourite bit is at the end when he's doing the free money here sign. And he runs out of space to write here. It reminded me of John Mulaney has a bit about when you write a happy birthday sign, you always run out of space.
And so
he kind of runs out of space as he's spray painting the sign. Yeah, it's interesting, but it just has a certain kind of it's just a bit odd.
I love this film. I love this film. This is what we part company here. I just thought this film was great.
Well, it has popped up, and something I realized watching all these films again is one of my favorite things at the minute, particularly in the year 2020, is the channel Talking Pictures TV.
Yes.
And you're a fan of Talking Pictures TV too.
I am indeed.
And if people are listening because we've got listeners around the world, but if you don't know what Talking Pictures TV is, it's this television channel that's based in the UK, that's on the regular UK free-to-air wavelengths, digital wavelengths. But it seems to have been around about 2 or 3 years, and I read about it. It's basically run by a guy who used to work in media and has been collecting old movies and copyrights, and they basically broadcast from an expanded garage at the bottom of their garden.
Shed. Yeah,
it's a family broadcast from a shed, but they show all these movies and TV shows that you really have forgotten about, that people have kind of passed by. And a few weeks ago, they did show The Magic Christian, and it got a huge amount of traction online. People were very interested to watch it again. I think they showed it about 3 or 4 times. But it's a fascinating little channel. And some of the other movies we're going to talk about have also popped up on Talking Pictures TV. It's what I find interesting about Talking Pictures TV is it gives you a context to kind of forgive some of these movies. If they're not very good, it doesn't matter, because you're signing up to see something that's just kind of different. Do you know what I mean?
No, exactly. And one of my sort of pet hates about the modern world, you know, stand by for 15 minutes on why I don't like the modern world.
Go on. Are you going to go full, Stephen Stills?
when I was a teenager all those years ago, you could stumble across this type of film.
Yes.
On BBC Two on a Saturday night. So they would run a series of kind of horror movies or sort of 60s movies. So I saw The Magic Christian, I saw Silent Running, I saw that type of film. Nowadays, you can't stumble across films like that. You know, you can see, how often has Indiana Jones, they just show that film.
Shaun
of the Dead. Exactly. I mean, they just continually, and there's nowhere to sort of stumble across. Across things is a great thing. And
Talking Pictures TV should call themselves the Stumble Across Channel. They had a few weeks ago, I found myself watching a Sean Connery film from 1974 set in Norway, where he's single-handedly trying to get rid of some some people who'd taken over a plane called Ransom. It was bonkers. It was great. And I'd never heard of it. So Magic Christian, sorry, did you give your mark out of 10 for Magic Christian?
You won't agree with this, but I'm going 7 out of 10 for Magic Christian.
Yeah, give it 2 or 3 out of 10. I just find it just...
Really? Really? You think it's as bad as Candy?
No, it's not as bad as Candy. So 4.3 or something, I guess.
4.3.
It just makes me feel uncomfortable. And maybe that's the point.
You were watching it, keep waiting for the kids or your wife to come into the room. That's why you were uncomfortable.
Say, what the hell is this?
How many times are you going to watch Raquel Welch?
Just once or twice. So, but that is Ringo's big movie debut, co-starring role. He's in The Beatles. He's in The Magic Christian. And then there's kind of a bit of a gear shift because The Beatles split. And we kind of get into a couple of movies where Ringo, it seems to me, or maybe this is obvious in retrospect, he's trying to become a bit of a hyphenate. You know, he's, you know, doing music, he's in movies, he's making movies, he's, you know, being all things to all people, he's appearing on different albums. And the next movie on the list is Blind Man from 1971. Yeah. And that is in the middle of Ringo's busyness.
It is. I mean, this is an incredibly busy period between 1970 and 72. So he's got 2 solo albums, standalone singles. He's recording with George and John and Yoko. Concert for Bangladesh. He's recording with Stephen Stills, Leon Russell, B.B. King. Phenomenal work rate.
Yeah. And trying to be a movie star.
And trying to be a movie star. So Blind Man, this is the film you said you had watched or hadn't watched?
No, this is the one film on the list that I have not watched because it's not on YouTube. I wasn't going to buy a DVD. It was just
Then for your benefit.
But I know somebody who did buy a DVD and...
I did buy the DVD, all for research.
For science.
And when I put the DVD in the DVD player,
that's what
it played
you do.
In yeah. Italian.
But it is an Italian spaghetti western, Blind Man.
Yes, but there were no subtitles, Jason. No.
But does Ringo speak in Italian?
It was all overdubbed very badly.
Classic spaghetti western style.
In Italian. But as you haven't, I'll describe this film for you. It is a gritty tale of double and triple crossing in the white slavery trade of the Old West, featuring... You might want to take notes at this point.
I'll start writing.
A blind bounty hunter.
Right.
who, with the help of his trusty seeing eye horse, takes on bloodthirsty bandits and the Mexican army in his quest to deliver 50 mail order brides to hard up miners in Texas.
Jeez, I mean,
we've all been there.
That old chestnut.
That old chestnut. Yeah, this is a crazy film.
From the clips and the trailers and things I've looked at, it does look good. I mean, it looks like an authentic spaghetti western.
It does. I mean, it has that real feel about it. And what I would say is, anybody sitting down to watch this who had seen Ringo in A Hard Day's Night and Help and Magical Mystery Tour and Magic Christian, this is not the same beast at all.
No.
It's an Alan Klein Abco production.
Which explains why Ringo's there.
Which kind of explains why he's there. And Alan Klein makes an uncredited appearance. You like this bit? Playing the part of a sweaty double-crossing bandit.
So, typecasting.
All he had to do was act natural.
All he had to do was turn up. and Matt Evans is in it, isn't
he? Yeah, he's in it as one of Klein's sidekicks. Ringo is sort of given pretty high billing in this, but it's a very small role in this film, and they're really sort of exploiting his name, I think, just to get people in. It's very violent. It's very dated in its treatment of the female characters. Ringo himself has some extremely hard to watch scenes of violence to women, and it's shocking now. It must have been more shocking if you were expecting a sort of mop top comedy, Magic Christian style.
Well, here's a top fact for you, because in the research for this, you were saying that this was filmed in Almeria in Spain.
Yes.
And I might have been on the set of Blind Man, because when I was a young kid, we used to go on a package holiday every summer. And I remember one year we went to Almeria in Spain, and there's two connections there. First one is that I would have been about 8, and we went to a place called Little Hollywood, which was a movie set open to the public where they shot spaghetti westerns. Now, history does not recall whether this was the exact place where they shot Blind Man, but it would seem likely if I visited a spaghetti western studio in Almeria in Spain that this is the same place.
I would have thought so.
You would think so. And my other connection to Almeria is on the same holiday is where I first experienced the Beatles. So it's a holiday I remember quite well.
Could I get you to autograph my DVD?
Well, no, it's funny because it was only years later I realized that there's a connection to Almeria, because that's where John made How I Won the War.
And
wrote Strawberry Fields. And I assuming, in retrospect, the reason why there was Beatles stuff on the streets of Almeria was because of the John Lennon connection. But I didn't put two and two together for about 10 or 15 years. So that was interesting to find out.
That was very good.
Yeah.
That's a good connection. That's a good connection.
But is it a good film, Stephen?
If you like spaghetti westerns, if you're a fan of that sort of, Lee Van Cleef, Clint Eastwood style, it's an interesting addition to the canon.
Okay.
But if you're a fan of Ringo Starr, I wouldn't recommend it. It's not one of the films that I would say, yes, you could just sit down and enjoy watching Ringo in this. It's not an easy watch, and he's not in it for very long.
Yeah.
5 out of 10.
5 out of 10. Okay, I can't give a rating because it's the one I haven't seen. I'm afraid, folks.
How would you rate Almeria?
Almeria's a nice part of the world, you know. Jeez.
Five out of ten.
I'd be happy to go anywhere at the minute, Stephen, to be honest. Right, viewers. Anyway, that'll date.
Moving on.
The next movie is a bit of a right turn, but it's fantastic. Now, here's the good stuff. Born to Boogie, 1972, a U-rated Apple Films production, directed by Ringo Starr, and it's a top-notch rock bio. It's not really, is it a biopic? It's certainly a Mark Bolan T-Rex movie.
It's a rockumentary, if you will.
But it's fantastic.
It's It is. It's a wonderful thing. And I have had this on DVD for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's only in the global pandemic that I sat down to watch it all. I'd kind of dipped in and out of it before, but I watched the whole thing. And it's marvelous. It's a marvelous
a movie.
Artifact.
It is an artifact, and it's fascinating. And the first thing I'll say is it is really interesting to see Ringo Starr from the Beatles with Mark Bolan from T-Rex hanging out. And, you know, the story is that Bolan was very enamored with the fact that Ringo from the Beatles was interested in him. But they have a nice rapport. Ringo, because Ringo's on camera for chunks of it, playing drums in a fantastic studio jamming session. But he's also kind of larking around with Mark Bolan. And he's, you know, it's very charming.
It is. So the format is there's that jam session, which takes place in the Apple basement in their studios. You've got live footage of a Wembley show by T-Rex. And then, as you say, you've got these kind of surreal interludes.
Yes.
Where generally Ringo was there kind of larking around with Mark Bolan or having tea, you know, in a kind of slightly surreal Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields kind of vibe.
The dinner table in the field scenario, classic.
Classic 67 rock setup, video.
But it's the studio session where it's Elton on the piano, Ringo on drums, Mark Bolan doing his thing, and they're singing like Little Richard's Tutti Frutti, and then Mark Bolan is sitting in Elton's piano doing Children of the Revolution. It's great.
If you watch none of this film other than that clip of Elton and Ringo and Mark, that's the highlight for me. You know, the live footage is great.
Well, the live footage, like how much Ringo directed this, he seems to have actually directed it. Live footage is really well captured. The angle, the low angles and the lack of, like, it's not very kinetic. The camera kind of just sits there and it films chunks, and it's really engaging to watch as opposed to fast cuts and,
I mean, it's very different in that sense that you say most concert footage, particularly now, you have sort of swinging cameras over the stage and cutaways and different angles. This is supposedly Ringo was sort of in the pit at the front of the stage, behind the camera, sort of directing these individual shots, and it gives you a real sense of being in the front row. At the concert, it's you know, some of the, you know, the bongo solo goes on perhaps a little bit too long, but, you know, again, it's of its time. But
but it's short. It's only like about 70 minutes anyway. It flies by, and
It sort of arose out of Ringo had this idea that he was going to make documentary films about Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, George Best. I'd like to see Ringo do a documentary about George Best. And that never really came to pass, but Mark Bolan was one of the subjects. And then this sort of became a theatrical release. And of course, at this stage, T-Rex...
Well, that's
T-Rex,
it. The timing
T-Rex
is perfect.
T-Rex mania, you know, Bolan mania. He is the new Beatles, I suppose.
Well, one of the things about Apple that, you know, we've kind of talked about a lot is that Apple was so many great ideas poorly executed, you know, and there are versions of every Apple idea where you can go, there's the same idea done very well. And but this thing does seem to line up that this is a great film made by Apple. This is the type of thing they could have been churning out. As you say, if they did do a George Best documentary, and other bits, this works really, really well.
Yes, if they had the sort of personnel, you know, the business people to sort of corral the creative ideas, this is exactly the type of thing they should have been doing. And Ringo is clearly brilliant at this.
Yeah, he's
you
really
know,
good.
As you say, a lot of it comes down, I suppose, to his sort of personal chemistry with Mark Bolan. But it's a very well executed, well crafted documentary.
And that acoustic Alice in Wonderland set, that's filmed in Titmuss Park, isn't it? So that's a Beatles connection right there.
Beatles connection right there. So again, it's this idea of, you know, everything moves very fast in pop. So you've got T-Rex and you've got Ringo from the old guard.
Yeah, and Ringo does seem old, even though there's not much difference.
Yes, he does. You know. It's very much Ringo is the sort of elder statesman.
It's about 7 years between Ringo and Mark Bone.
But at 30 years old, I suppose Ringo is the elder statesman in this setup.
So Mark's out of 10 for Born to Boogie.
I'd give it 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. It's a great little time capsule. It's really something. And there's a bit of Mark Bolan revivalism going on at the minute, which is
there
nice.
There is. And just before we leave that, I'd just like to say the premiere.
Oh, yeah.
The after show party was at Tramps Nightclub. And you had T-Rex, Ringo, Elton, Bernie Taupin, Keith Moon, and Donovan.
Drink might have been taken.
Drink might have been taken.
And Donovan told him to take it. He told him everything. What
Donovan
to do.
Was, uncredited there. But
The next movie, we probably should actually mention as a side point that Ringo has also appeared in 200 Motels, the Frank Zappa film at this point. Yes. We're not going to go into that, but it's. I've seen 200 Motels.
I can hear the contempt in your voice.
You know,
I've never seen this movie. I've seen clips and I've seen lots of stills with Ringo dressed up like Frank Zappa. He plays Larry the Dwarf.
Yeah. And so Ringo's dressed up as Frank Zappa and he gives a very odd speech to camera about how to, but what to do with orchestras. And it's all very kind of bleak. And 200 Motels is a Frank Zappa film, which was made in 1970. It was shot in London on videotape and transferred over onto film and sort of became one of these kind of midnight showing things. It depends on what your take is on Frank Zappa. And I definitely did see this as part of this Alex Cox movie drama on BBC Two back in the day, because I found his introduction on YouTube and watched it. And that's when I saw it. And I went back and looked at it again. And you're either into the Zappa thing or you're not. And I've tried so hard to get into Zappa, but the older I get, I'm just not built for that cynicism, that kind of, it's, you know, I think it's dating very, very poorly, his stuff, you know.
I think as a teenager, as a kind of 14, 15 year old,
he seems an amazing iconoclast. You think this guy's fantastic. And I remember seeing his autobiography about 1990, a friend of mine had it, and reading it and thinking, this guy's amazing. And they're like, okay, I'm going to try and listen to some of his albums. Oh, Jesus Christ.
I think the problem for me is there's so much of it.
Yes. That's not a problem with King Crimson, though.
No, and it's such a sort of diverse. So, you get relatively straightforward things like Apostrophe.
Yeah.
You know, where you've kind of got Jack Bruce's appearing on that, and then you've got some kind of sort of minor scatological humorous songs, you know, Don't Eat the Yellow Snow. His song titles are more interesting often than the work. But
he also pulled that stunt. Like in 200 Motels, Ringo is dressed as Frank Zappa giving a speech. And he did the exact same thing on The Monkees a few years earlier, where he dresses Mike Nesmith as Frank Zappa and he tries to present himself. And Zappa appears in Head as well.
It's a rehash of...
Well, all these things are kind of interlinked, but I know people who love Frank Zappa, and if you love Zappa...
I was going to say we're alienating so many people.
No, I can understand what it's like to jump into like a massive body of work and to either get it or not get it, but I don't get it. But anyway, Ringo's in that movie as well, and he makes one or two other cameos we'll mention in a sec. But the next big movie that he is in is possibly his most important one, which is That'll Be the Day. And when I say important, I think Ringo kind of disappears in That'll Be the Day, because most of the other movies he's in, you're like, oh, there's Ringo.
Yeah.
And in That'll Be the Day, I think it's possibly his best kind of capture.
I think so. You're not conscious of the fact that, you know, hey, it's Ringo Starr. Yeah.
So That'll Be the Day comes out in 1973 and it stars David Essex. And how would you describe it?
It really has a lot of parallels, I think, with the early Beatles. So this guy, the David Essex character, is very good at school, but he's very bored. He runs out on his exams and runs off to join a kind of fun fair. Has lots of adventures. Comes back home, and then ditches his fiance. In a parallel with the way his own father had run out on him as a child. And he's last seen sort of heading down the road with his guitar, setting up the sequel.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a great movie, and I've seen it a few times, and again, it popped up on Talking Pictures TV recently, and yeah, I was like, I'm just going to watch this again.
And it's bleak. This is probably the sort of arguably the best British rock film. Mm. You think? The key to its success is that it stars lots of people who were there.
Yeah.
So like Ringo, we should say, plays the part of a barman
in the holiday camp kind of holiday camp area.
In a holiday camp, he's a bit of a Jack the Lad, and of course Ringo played the Butlins' holiday camps with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, and they're just tapping into that late 50s.
I think that's why he fits so well. He's not acting; he's just reliving part of his life.
Absolutely. And you know, Ringo sort of, his character gets beaten up and sort of disappears. And maybe it's because, you know, I'm coming at it from the nothing is real standpoint, but the film does sort of dip a little bit once Ringo brings a lot to this film.
Well, there's a lot of, because when the band are playing, you know, it's Billy Fury and Keith Moon who are in the band playing at the camp, isn't it? So what I like about That'll Be the Day is, it really represents well the boredom that was in people's lives in that sort of, you know, 1950s phase. Like, you read so many books about Elvis came along and we couldn't believe it. But you watch That'll Be the Day and you're like, my God, this is just, did they capture that ennui fantastically? You know, what are we going to do now? There isn't much going on, you know?
Yeah. No, I think this is it. It's perfect kind of snapshot. The screen, this was a film that was written by Ray Connolly.
Yes.
So again, there's more Beatles connection there. People will know Ray Connolly, you know, he's a rock journalist, I suppose is how you would describe him. He worked for the Evening Standard. He interviewed the Beatles in the '60s. He was a journalist to whom Lennon confided that he had left the Beatles and then said, keep that to yourself. And he did. And then Lennon criticized him for doing that. There's a very good archive. There's a book. It was originally a website, but there's the Ray Connolly Beatles Archive, which is a very good book, which collects various interviews. And supposedly he was due to interview John the day that he died.
Oh, right.
But he went to sort of speak to Ringo about the holiday camp and about the, he spoke to Neil Aspinall because he had never been to Butlins, a holiday camp himself. And he suddenly then in having that conversation realized that Ringo would be the perfect person for this role.
Mm. Yeah. It's a great film. And like many films of this era, you know, sometimes in the modern era, you forget how to watch old films. It just sort of ends.
Yes.
So you're like watching, oh my God, you know, what's going on? And it just sort of, he walks off into the sunset at the end. And there, it does set up a sequel, Stardust, which Ringo isn't in.
It does, but I'm not sure from looking at the Ray Connolly sort of website and his sort of recounting that he was intending to have a sequel.
Right.
I think it was just the case that, you know, the end was him leaving, walking out on his fiancée the way his father had walked out on him as a child. And that was the sort of the end. And he says that he was inspired by the Harry Nilsson song, 1941.
Yes. A father had a son and walked out the door.
Father had a son, which is, of course, Harry Nilsson's
story.
Experience, his story. But it then sets up the sequel. Ringo declined to be in the sequel and they cast Adam Faith, who people who aren't from the UK might not know. He was a sort of late 50s, early 60s singer. And he was cast in the same character, but just a different
Stardust
actor.
Is crazy. Stardust is crazy. It's great.
It's bizarre. It's bizarre. But supposedly Ringo declined to be in the sequel because he said, having lived through the experience in reality as a member of the Beatles, I don't want to go there. So Stardust is really about this meteoric rise to fame and sort of collapse of the main character into kind of drug addiction.
And what would your marks out of 10 be for That'll Be the Day?
I would give it Nine.
I think nine is generous.
Ringo, if Ringo had been all the way to the end, I think I'd have given it 10. But nine, I think.
So we kind of talked about this arc of Ringo's career where he's in the Beatles and he's in movies and then he's solo and he's making a name for himself and he's doing That'll Be the Day and Born to Boogie and, you know, giving it a, you know, Blind Man, giving it a good go. But then we tilt into the last phase where perhaps things are happening more for the fun of it. And we mentioned a moment ago Harry Nilsson, and he shuffles into the frame for our next movie on the countdown, if you like Casey Kasem, which is 1974's Son of Dracula.
Yes.
Do you want to give us the Son of Dracula summary?
Well, again, this is a standard rock and roll vampire movie. Yeah. The main thing is recounting the coronation of Harry Nilsson, playing the part of Count Down as King of the Netherworld at a monsters convention held in the basement dungeon of a horror museum.
There you go.
And no, just the usual.
It's your broad take. First of all, Son of Dracula is, as we said, it's Ringo and Harry having a bit of a laugh, you could say.
Yes.
But it is made by Apple. It is an Apple film. I know it's 1974 and Apple is kind of going to the wall, but it is made by Apple.
It is. And supposedly Ringo bankrolled this personally to the tune of, you know, several hundred thousand pounds.
And what's your take on Son of Dracula? Because I know how I feel about it.
Well, I knew the album before I knew the movie. And the album is quite good. But the most interesting thing about the album is the cover with that kind of fold out Harry Nilsson vampire cloak.
Yeah.
Then I sort of read about it and I knew it by its reputation. And then I started watching little bits of it and I thought, oh, this is a terrible, terrible, terrible movie. And I watched it for the first time all the way through, I suppose, back in March. And then I watched it again. And then I watched it for a third time. And I have to say, every time I watch it, it just gets better and better.
It's really quite good. I mean, it's bad, but it's really enjoyable. I mean, it's one thing where you're watching something bad and you're like, you know, this is a waste of my time. But Son of Dracula is one of those things where, again, if I flicked across the TV and it popped on, I'm like, but I haven't seen it on TV. It seems to have disappeared. It is a lot of fun, and there are lots of really good things to recommend about it. Would you agree?
I would. It's very frustrating that it's a bad second, third, fourth, fifth generation
copy on YouTube.
This is. I would love to see a kind of remastered, cleaned up print of this film.
My feeling is like Ringo plays Merlin and he's reprising his role as the Magical Mystery Tour wizard with his hat and his beard and his overacting. And Ringo is he's not very good in this.
I have to say, Ringo is probably the least
good.
I'm trying to think of the right word. The least good. Ringo is probably the least interesting part of this film.
And what is interesting is that Nilsson is really good.
He is very good.
And actually, he should have done more acting. He fits in, because the thing with this type of movie, Son of Dracula, and it reminded me, you know, at this time we're talking that, you know, Hammer were kind of in doing their movies. And what Hammer movies would have, and I'm not a horror movie expert, but they would always have great actors in them. And there are great actors dotted around Son of Dracula and, you know, doing the hokey, you know, script, whatever it is. Yeah. But Harry, I think, does the sad vampire thing really quite well.
He does. He is excellent. And I'd only ever seen him in a sort of a TV, clips from an American TV show where he sort of played the part of a singer. So he's playing himself. But no, he is actually very good. And he is probably the best thing. And as you say, again, there's lots of British character actors. You've got Dennis Price, Freddie Jones, Susanna Lee. It absolutely wants to be that kind of campy Hammer horror style film, but with rock and roll.
And it's not a bad idea, because if you think about what's in the ether at the time, you have movies like Young Frankenstein being funny. Yep. You have movies like The Rocky Horror, which goes on to become very influential. And, you know, it's not a million miles away to think that Son of Dracula could have, if it had landed properly, gone into that space somewhere.
I think Rocky Horror is a very good sort of comparison. Mm. And I think it wouldn't have taken very much for this to sort of you know, build up that sort of slow build to cult following.
Yeah.
But this, and I'm guessing it's probably because of the demise of Apple.
Yes, that it just didn't get a fair bite of the Apple.
Yes. so that it doesn't do well on first release, but as you say, Rocky Horror or With Nail and I, those type of films that aren't particularly well appreciated when they're first released, but suddenly they just, well, not suddenly, but over time they build and they gradually sort of achieve this cult status. I think this would be, I think this really needs to be cleaned up and
put out again.
I would buy it.
I
know that's my catchphrase, but I would definitely buy this.
But what I think is great about it is, you know, the thing that is really worth seeing it for are some of the performances. So Harry Nilsson is this vampire who after 100 years has to take over the mantle of the family, blah, blah, blah. And all he wants to do is boogaloo. All he wants to do is rock and roll and play with the band. Yeah. And there's a fantastic performance scene of Jump Into the Fire, which is a song that just keeps coming back to life. LCD Sound System have a great version and all the rest. And that's some band who are playing Jump Into the Fire. Who's in that band?
We've got John Bonham. You may have heard of him.
Yes.
Klaus Voormann.
Yes.
Maybe heard of him. Peter Frampton.
Comes Alive.
And Bobby Keys.
Yeah.
And Keith Moon takes a turn.
Keith Moon constantly popping up wherever Ringo's in front of a camera.
So you've got Ringo, Harry Nilsson, Keith Moon, John Bonham, you know, you kind of get the vibe that must have been going on.
But this is what
set.
We're talking about, where the lifestyle is taking over from the movie making, and that's where the suffering is. But Son of Dracula is definitely worth looking at. It's got the Channel Tunnel in it, about 15 years before the Channel Tunnel is built.
That's insane, because, okay, you can kind of think, well, we've got a tunnel, but it's...
They got it right.
They got it absolutely right. It's like Harry arrives in the UK in a hearse, which is on a train transporter. So they got it right that, oh, you have to put your car on a train to get it across... This was 14 years before the Channel Tunnel was even begun.
And there's some great views of the West End when he's walking around the West End, which is nice.
That is probably my favourite sort of scene, apart from the musical numbers, where Harry is kind of wandering through the rain-soaked
old Soho
West End.
When
old
it's still Soho. A bit kind of dirty.
Yeah, it's great. The intriguing thing, and I think we mentioned this in our 1974 episode, is obviously Ringo had a little bit of a kind of... failure of confidence in this, and he called Graham Chapman in to write an entirely new script that they could overdub onto the existing film, and they recorded a kind of alternative soundtrack. And I'm thinking, does that exist somewhere?
If that exists, that'd be amazing, because Son of Dracula isn't particularly funny per se. It's kind of the premise is funny, but it's actually trying to do a horror thing as well. It's not full of gags.
No, I think that's the sort of the failing, is it's neither particularly scary. It's a little bit campy. It's not particularly funny. And I say Ringo does not give a good performance. And we know that Ringo is capable in this kind of environment. And I do wonder if he suddenly realized that he was looking at hundreds of thousands of pounds of his own money disappearing, and the mantle of producer was sort of weighing slightly heavily on him. Everything he does is sort of delivered in that deadpan, flat...
Yeah, this kind of pantomimey acting that he does.
Yeah, it's a very exaggerated. That's exactly it. It is a kind of pantomime. But if this was cleaned up and given a DVD or a Blu-ray release, complete with an alternative soundtrack that you could, you know, watch the second version of it, I mean, this would be great.
Absolutely. I could stick it in a double disc thing with the album itself, you know, I picked up Slade in Flame recently. It's a nice album. DVD set, the kind of thing you want. Did you notice in the background of... Oh, by the way, the Harry Nilsson's vampire character is called Count Down, which is a joke that just keeps not giving. But did you notice in the apartment that he's living in that the furniture was Ringo or Robin furniture?
No, I did not.
There you go. That crazy sliding circular Ringo and Robin shelves are in the background from Ringo's furniture company.
You know what this means? I'm going to have to watch it again.
I think you should. Right now.
Perhaps Ringo, if Ringo is listening, he could get in touch and let us know, does the alternative soundtrack exist, and why is this not
It's a great thing.
Being revisited.
And we did mention in 1974 that the episode that Ringo and Harry were in preliminary talks to do a TV special as well at the same time.
Yes.
And some of that footage has appeared since. Like, it's basically about 20 seconds of test footage with animation. But it's very interesting to see. But Ringo, Son of Dracula, is definitely not as bad as its reputation suggests. I mean, you know, it's not great, but it's got a huge curiosity value, great musical performances. And if you're in the right mood, it'll pass 90 minutes very pleasantly.
I'm going to give it 7 out of 10.
7 out of 10. Yeah, I think if you're in the right mood, 7 out of 10. If you're talking about it's 2 out of 10. Yeah, but if you're in the mood, it's 7 out of 10. Yeah,
I think so.
And around the same time, Ringo does another cameo in Listomania. Not a movie I've seen in full. I've watched Ringo's bits.
I've watched
Ken Russell's
bits of it.
Son of Tommy, in a way. It's just...
If you like Tommy, stick with Tommy.
Yeah, exactly. So we're into the home stretch now of Ringo movies, and we're kind of heading into
the good stuff,
the regretful stuff.
So we've got years.
So we've got two movies to come onto next, and the first one is the one that's probably gone down in legend as being the worst of the worst, which is 1977's or 78's.
78.
I think it was made in 77, released in 78. Sextet. And if you've never heard of Sextet, you are lucky. And I think we should wrap up the podcast and you should go home and never hear about it. If you want to learn about Sextet,
proceed at your own risk.
Yes. Listen now, Stephen, tell us about Sextet.
This is a 1978 American musical comedy film starring the 84-year-old Mae West in the lead, wait for it, sex kitten role.
Mm.
So the plot is basically that Mae West, Marlo Manners, and her new sixth husband arrive at their honeymoon hotel and are unable to consummate the marriage because they're constantly interrupted by dress fittings, photo sessions, as well as various men, including her former husbands, who are all want to have sex with Mae West and retrieve an incriminating cassette tape of her bawdy memoirs. And quite frankly, once again, we've all been there.
We've all been there. Good use of the word bawdy again.
Which of us cannot say that we have burst in on an ex's honeymoon trying to retrieve a copy of her memoirs?
So we need to point out that when she arrives with her sixth husband, this person is played by Timothy Dalton, who goes on to be 007 James, Timothy Bond.
I should have checked how old he was, but you know, he's not old.
He's not old, and all he wants to do is
have sex with Mae West.
Yes, 84-year-old Mae West. And all these ex-husbands keep coming into the picture to distract and to it's
as bad as it sounds. It's beyond awful. But again, the cast list.
Yeah.
So you've got Ringo,
yes.
George Hamilton, Walter Pidgeon, Dom DeLuise, Tony Curtis, Keith Moon again.
The first person you see in this movie is the late great Regis Philbin.
Yes.
So I've never watched Sextet, and for the purposes of chatting today, I thought I really have to bite the bullet and watch this. And I put it on, and Regis Philbin comes on as a reporter, which is just. It's just crazy, and it answers. There are so many questions raised, like how, this woman is the character that Mae West plays, who's, as we said, is 84, is so famous that there are reporters in the hotel lobby reporting on whether the marriage has been consummated or not, because that's normal.
There are crowds outside. It's literally every move that she makes is being commented upon and followed and reported on, and it's weird. I mean, it's just it's terrible. And they just, I mean, she's very made up, and they just sort of move her around the set like she's on casters, and they get her to deliver her famous, you know, come up and see me sometime, or it's not the man in my life, it's the life in my man. I mean, it's a series of well, catchphrases.
The legend of the movie is that she was wearing an earpiece and she was being fed her lines.
Yes.
And, you know,
I can believe it.
I can believe it. And she's always kind of photographed in this kind of blurry, fuzzy lit old Hollywood kind of way.
A lot of Vaseline on the lens of the camera. Yeah.
And all her lines are delivered in that kind of Mae West tone.
Yeah.
And every line she delivers, there's always about six people in the room who deliver about a 1.5 second burst of laughter, which then stops. And then she goes, no, 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 no. And then everyone laughs and stops again.
Yeah.
And it's really strange. And when I was watching this, it's on YouTube. And I was about 10 minutes in and I was like, please, please make this stop. And but, you know, on YouTube, you can change the speed, the playback speed of something you're watching. And okay. I'm telling you, folks, if you put Sextet up to, you know, 1.75 or two times the speed, Mae West sounds like 1930s Mae West, because okay. it everybody's performance is slowed down to match her performance, which makes it stultifyingly dull to watch. And what? Oh god, it's all coming
back. Apparently she was incredibly deaf. So it was very difficult to kind of give her direction. And there's a story about a scene in an elevator, which took most of the day to film. And after the scene, the director called RAP, but she wasn't within hearing range. So she just stayed in the elevator.
Oh, God, love her.
For half an hour before anyone realized that they had to go. I think what I've written here in my notes is that the low point is Mae West reciting the lyrics to Babyface.
Yeah.
If it were not for the world's worst Beatles cover, which is Dom DeLuise singing Honey Pie.
Well, that's bizarre. Dom DeLuise just starts singing Honey Pie for no particular
reason.
And when I was watching it for the first time, I was about 10 minutes in when the first song came on, and I was like, oh, Jesus, no, there's music. There's singing and dancing as well. It's so many things done badly. It's really... really weird. There's this athletic room scene where Mae West kind of wanders into a room with about, you know,
it's like an American basketball team or something.
Yeah, and just starts, you know, doing all these lines, and everyone's laughing at her, and it's
with her, Jason, laughing with her.
But like, one of the ex-husbands is George Hamilton, who's just come off The Godfather, you know, one of the greatest films of all time, and he's doing like a Godfather pastiche in it. It's so strange.
Awful.
Yeah, it's awful.
And
Ringo is doing very loud, very broad, very bad. He's in it for about 4 minutes. I timed it, and he's not very good.
He plays the part of a former husband, I think, with some weird sort of geographically inexact accent.
Yeah.
And he's clearly off his head.
He is. You can tell when Ringo's neck beard goes out of control. That's that. They're the bad Ringo years, you know?
I'm sure he has no memory of this film whatsoever.
Well, I found a bit of footage of him being interviewed about it recently, and he's like, you know, he's quite, he knows so, it's not a good film. And he's like, listen, just wanted to meet Mae West and hang out. And, you know, she was, you know, a legend. And
but the highlight of the film?
Keith Moon, isn't it?
Keith Moon.
Keith Moon
appears as a dress designer.
Yeah.
He's in it only for about 2 minutes.
Yes.
But it's worth watching. Those 2 minutes. Don't watch the whole film. Find the 2 minutes with Keith Moon. He is hilarious. And this is how you imagine Keith Moon behaved in real life.
Well, you know, Keith Moon does that thing where, you know, he pops up in Tommy or whatever, you know, he's doing these little mini micro roles, and he's just perfect. Yeah. He's got great presence, great charisma. He's brilliantly funny. You don't want to watch him for an hour and a half, but he's just very, very, very good in this thing.
Yeah. Keith Moon is one of those people that I think I would like to spend some time in his company, but probably no more than 5 or 10 minutes in his company.
I mean, broadly speaking, some of the stuff he did was a bit grim.
He'd be great crack for about 10 minutes, and then I think it would wear thin. So 2 minutes in this, but he is clearly enjoying himself. And I imagine that was one take.
Yeah.
And then literally he walks out the door and keeps talking as he leaves. And
There's you know, spoiler alert, but it kind of is revealed towards the end of the movie that the Timothy Dalton character is like this 007 secret spy, which is like, oh my God, what a twist kind of thing.
Yeah.
And a bit of foreshadowing for Timothy Dalton's later career. So, would you tell people to watch it?
No. I didn't hesitate. No, I originally had marked this as 3 out of 10, but I actually think it's probably 2 out of 10.
It's really, really bad. But however, I'm going to flip something just for the sake of it, because, you know, if you think about it, Stephen, maybe there's something broader at play here, because I have a theory.
I was just about to say, do you have a theory, Jason?
I have a theory. And my theory is actually that Ringo is playing the long game, that sextet is the flip of candy and makes a very serious point about ageist views and sexuality.
Have I revealed myself to be ageist?
Just saying, why is it that, you know, we are all kind of laughing and mocking a sexualized 84-year-old who wants to bed all her ex-husbands, but we are not horrified about the movie about an 18-year-old being chased by 6 old men?
I was horrified by that movie too.
You said it was the best movie ever. I'll rewind the tape.
Candy?
Candy, yeah. No?
No. I didn't say that.
No, you didn't. No, you didn't.
Rewind the tape. I'm appalled by all of these movies.
But there you go. Sextet, if you see it hand in hand with Candy, they're actually the yin and yang, no?
Oh, I'm not watching them again.
No. That's a very difficult leap to make.
Do you think there's Candy and sextet in a double bill at your local Odeon?
Oh my God! Well, if you know, some cinemas need to be kept empty these days, so that'd be a good way of doing it. I think there is a school of thought that says that about sextet, that says good on Mae West for making this movie about a sexy 84-year-old, and you know, we should rethink our position on these kind of attitudes in society. But
yeah, I mean, I
still doesn't make it a good movie.
It doesn't make it a good movie, and I can see that. But you do get a sense that she was in no way in control of this.
No, and if like the cast or the credits at the start say it's based on her play, and it does have, it's very much set up like a play. Yeah. But the play is written about 30 or 40 years earlier and was never really produced. So they basically took this idea off the scrap heap. It wasn't a play written about somebody who's in their 80s. It was written about somebody who's in their 40s who'd had a load of husbands. And, you know, that might...
It still doesn't make sense. I could see it. I mean, I suppose these days it might be about someone who was in their 60s or their 70s, you know, on the basis that 70 is the new 40 or something. But I'm clinging to that.
You keep saying that. It doesn't make it true.
Yeah, maybe. But I felt uncomfortable because you kind of think... I don't think she's in on it. That's exactly it. I don't think she's... in control, and I think people are, much like ourselves, are laughing at her rather than with her.
Yeah.
She's not present. You know, you kind of get a sense that she's not aware of really what's going on, and she's just...
because she was someone with a fantastic legacy who actually created a screen persona back in the early days of talkies, which was very striking and strident and important, you know?
Yeah.
So I do think it is a pity that this is her.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not taking away from her kind of importance as an actress sort of back in the day, but I think this is a very unfortunate sort of end to them.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you know, it's sad that her career sort of has this punchline, you know.
Yeah, but you're bringing the party down.
Sorry. Well, then let's end Ringo's cinematic odyssey with our next.
You miss something? What I want to do is give a shout out to another podcast.
Oh, I don't know. Oh, go on then.
Smush Pod.
Yes, indeed.
Which is an excellent podcast. Primarily started off about the Bond movies, but sort of diversified. This is a very funny episode on
sextet,
which you should not listen to if you're driving or operating heavy machinery. It's highly recommend you check that out. It's much more entertaining than the movie.
That's interesting. I didn't know there were other podcasts. That's interesting.
There are no other music podcasts.
So on to the final big tentpole Ringo film, which is kind of, I think, the end of Ringo's cinematic ambition or career, certainly as a headliner, which is 1981's Caveman.
I'm guessing this is your favorite film.
Well, you know, no, it's not. But, well, give us the synopsis of Caveman.
Okay. The first thing is this features no dialogue, but in the course of slapstick adventures, cavemen discover marijuana, fire, invent roast chicken, music, weapons, and learn how to walk upright. Ringo becomes the tribe's new leader, and he and his mate, who interestingly is not Barbara Bach, who is in this film, yes, live happily ever after.
Yeah, his mate is played by Shelley Long, who obviously went on to be...
Cheers, Diane.
Yes, insane Cheers. Female cast member from Cheers. And it's Caveman is... It feels dated.
Well, everything from the 80s is dated in a way. No, but in a way that things from the 70s and things from the 90s often are not. I mean, you know, it stars Dennis Quaid for a start.
Here's what I think about Caveman, because we're talking about some of these movies and we're having a laugh and all the rest, but sometimes you're kind of thinking, why was this made or how did this happen? And I kind of think, no, I can kind of understand a slight logic in how Caveman became made, you know, got made as a movie, but it seems as if it was a couple of years too late. It reminds me of that kind of run of movies that Mel Brooks had, where he had Young Frankenstein, which is a black and white film, and he had Blazing Saddles, a Western. He had Silent Movie, which is a silent movie. He had High Anxiety. So it's one of those kind of comedy genre pieces, because it's kind of a pseudo silent Ray Harryhausen film.
It is. It's a kind of send up of what's that Raquel Welch film, 1 million years BC. That, or as you say, the kind of stop motion dinosaurs and things like that. It is a send up of that. But as you say, it's a couple of years too late.
Yeah, and you could kind of see, you know, if it had been like a Mel Brooks type film, and it had even maybe starred Mel Brooks in the Ringo role, you know, you can kind of see, you know, how that would come to be, because it was directed by Carl Gottlieb, who sort of was in, I think he might have been did he work with Mel Brooks, or he certainly was of that era. And, you know, it's got a reasonably strong cast. You know, Barbara Bach is there, and she's just come off The Spy Who Loved Me a year or two earlier. So you can kind of see how it might have been a good idea, but it gets old very fast, the premise of it.
It seems to me that it's a kind of 30-minute TV show, or it's a couple of sketches that have just been kind of elongated.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a bit kind of slapsticky, but as you say, it's very dated.
Yeah. You know, there is some lovely stop motion animations in it, but I just associate that with movies 20 or 30 years earlier, you know?
Yeah. It's not the first Flintstones movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of comedy. Mm. You think, well, that did it a little better than this.
Yeah.
And
high praise. You
know, high praise. And the kind of lack of dialogue is that just gets, I didn't make it to the end of this movie, I have to say.
It's you'd certainly skip through it on YouTube, you know, and it's got one or two nice little bits in it, and I see what they're reaching for, but just no.
But you see what I mean? Is it kind of like a sketch, or is it a punchline in search of a joke? But the best bit is where they're all sitting around the campfire, and somebody blows into a kind of a jug and realizes it produces a musical sound, and this kind of, they start adding to it, and they discover music, and that would be a great little kind of Saturday Night Live sketch or something.
And it has a Beatles reference right at the start, doesn't it?
So bear in mind when this came out in 1981. So it opens in the way that all prehistoric films open, with a you know, 1 zillion years ago on the 9th of October. Which is John's birthday.
John's birthday. And this movie came out in April 81, just a few months.
Yeah, so it seems to be just a little bit of a nod to John. And, yeah. But this is, as you say, this is the point where I think, you know, Ringo is enjoying the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that his co-star, Dennis Quaid, was enjoying the lifestyle.
Certainly.
And Barbara Bach... too.
Yes. And the Ringo at this point is in his 40s. There aren't going to be any more Ringo starring vehicles, and but you know, himself and Barbara meet up, and they are still together to this day. So if his career has left him with in a happier place, then more power to his elbow, I guess.
All's well. And this is the promotional interview that we've talked about before, where he goes on the John Davidson show and is completely hammered.
Yeah. And he's in a bad way. And there is some interviews of them together, Ringo and Barbara, on the Today Show in summer 1981 in the wake of Caveman coming out. And they're a bit, you know,
refreshed.
Yeah, they're not as bad as the John Davidson interview, but they're still obviously high on life, and which they've subsequently been quite candid about talking about at the time. But yeah, Caveman, it doesn't really even have any kind of curiosity value or, you know, fun value that Son of Dracula has. So I can't. No. What's your final rating?
I'm giving it 4 out of 10, and I'm saying this is fairly unwatchable unless you're stoned. I imagine.
Yes. Stoned like a caveman and would have a stone thrown at him.
Yeah. That's it, Jason. That's it.
That's what that means. So that's Caveman. So that's the kind of the arc of Ringo's films from 68 to 81. And whether it could have gone in another direction, I don't know. But there's a couple of postscripts we might wrap up on talking about. The first one is we'll do 2 or 3 hours now on a movie called Give My Regards to Broad Street that came out in, let me just check my papers, 1984. And it was written by somebody called Paul McCartney.
Mr. McCartney. Well, sadly, we don't have time for that. But I if we can leave that, I promise you, we will do at some point
it'll
in the future.
It'll never happen.
We'll do an entire episode on this film, which I have never seen.
Yes, I do think it would be fun to put you in front of it for the first time and record your responses.
I've seen bits of it.
Yes,
you know, but you've looked
at those pictures on the sleeve of the soundtrack and wondered, wow, I'd love to see that film.
Yeah.
But there are two things that left that we're going to pick. One is a favourite of yours and one is a favourite of mine.
I feel already I'm being...
I think your choice is excellent. The one I meant to mention first is a 2016 film that Ringo pops up in, which is Popstar, Never Stop Never Stopping, which is a very, very funny film. And
it's very funny.
Yeah, it's from the Lonely Island people. If you know the Lonely Island, they're a trio who were on Saturday Night Live, who went off to do greater things. So Andy Samberg is the star of Popstar Never Stop Never Stopping. And Yoram and Kiva are the two of the members of Lonely Island who also appear in the film and direct it. And it's another mockumentary about Sandberg's character is Connor For Real, who is
For Real,
who's, you know, trying to make a comeback. And it's very, very funny. But Ringo appears, there's these talking heads that pop up throughout the movie, kind of talking about the history and their relationship with the band. And Ringo just pops up as one of these talking heads. And it's very funny to just have him in the middle of all this acting seriously.
Do you think we get Mr. Sandberg on the podcast?
I would love to get Andy Sandberg. I'm a huge Lonely Island fan. And, you know, they did the digital shorts on SNL for years. A lot of SNL turning up on today's podcast. And their musical comedy is sensational. There's just so much good stuff. Their three albums are fantastic.
They do my favorite ever Christmas song. I'll leave it at that.
Well, I think I know which one you're talking about. That's Popstar Never Stop Never Stopping, which is a very silly and it's definitely 18s rated comedy that Ringo pops up in. But you pushed me in the direction of something else, which I think we need to talk about.
It might be Ringo's finest moment.
We've been looking for a 10 out of 10 moment. What is it?
This is the Powerpuff Girls Dance Pants, which came out. It's a TV short and it came out in 2014. It's an animated film, I suppose. And he plays the character Fibonacci Sequins.
It's a great mathematical pun. Like, he's a glam rock sequins guy, but he's also a professor of maths, this character. And
this is the best thing Ringo's ever done.
It is really funny and charming. And, you know, it's not even telling you that it's Ringo, you know?
It's obviously him. People will think we're just kind of, you know, being facetious here, but it is genuinely entertaining. It's very, very funny. And if you ever wanted to see a cartoon Ringo in a tutu singing, "I wish I was a Powerpuff Girl," this is the place to go.
This is exactly it, and it is very, very funny. The Powerpuff Girls is a funny cartoon. It's one of those things that you don't mind the kids putting on. There is a
we started this by saying, you know, there's language and there's some inappropriate things. This is entirely appropriate for
the
everyone,
whole family. And there is a family. There is a another Powerpuff Girls episode called Meet the Beatles, spelled BEAT-ALLS, who are the Powerpuff Girls have to fight a group of supervillains called the Beatalls. But this cartoon, it's another 10-minute Powerpuff cartoon, but it has more Beatle references in it than the Free as a Bird video. It's worth worth pulling out, because it came on the television in our house one day, and I was like, oh, I know, I get all these jokes. I know what's going on.
Are we looking at doing a special episode on the Powerpuff Girls?
I think there's probably a whole podcast. On Powerpuff Girls Beatles crossover. But I think it's nice that Ringo at this stage is kind of popping up in things where he's what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, there are comments online about, you know, oh, how could he possibly do this or this? I think it just, he is clearly incredibly comfortable with his role, his legacy, his position. And I think it's great that he's doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, he loves the all-round entertainer thing. He loves being famous. When he did find his groove, you know, we haven't even mentioned Thomas the Tank Engine, but that was something that, you know, suited him like a glove.
Yeah, and I mean, at the time, people were sort of saying, oh, this is such a come down, or this is, but, you know, again, it's back to your point about him playing the long game.
Yeah.
You know, that has legs, that has traction, that's still something, and it's great. It's just fun and it's enjoyable, and that's, you know,
Ringo all over.
Peace and love. Yeah,
peace and love. That's all he wants to do, is just bring a little bit of joy. But what do you think, folks? Have you seen any of these Beatles films? Have we made you want to see any of these Beatles films? Have we made you want to take your television and throw it into the sea? Let us know.
Have you cancelled your subscription to this podcast?
Well, you know, listen, sometimes it can't all be copiously dense facts.
We watched this for most, this is the most time I've put into any episode.
Hours. I'm telling you, folks, the playback speed on YouTube is your friend. So that's my top tip, you know, that's the only way to watch Sextet in about half an hour. But let us know what you think. It's certainly a curious fingerprint of movies that he has made, and it's part of the Beatles magic that the only reason we're talking about these things today in the 21st century is that there's a thread that connects them back to everybody's favorite group, the Beatles, and that's just the magic that makes the whole thing interesting, you know.
Yes, I agree. And once you start watching these films, it's the little connections that pop up all the way through his career, you know, whether it's Dom DeLuise and Sextet singing Honey Pie, or the fact that Keith Moon keeps popping up, it's an Apple Films, or, you know, Harry Nilsson is in Son of Dracula, and Harry Nilsson's song 1941 inspires That'll Be the Day. It's a weird...
You just realize you're living in a Beatles universe, and we just need to get used to it.
Absolutely.
So let us know what you think, folks. Have you seen these? Do you want to go see them? We're available in all the usual places. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod. You can go to Facebook for the private Nothing Is Real Facebook group, and Stephen will let you in. And we're popping up in other online places as well. We hope you join us next time. Thanks for listening. For Nothing Is Real, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll see you next time. Bye. Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.